Jersey.
Finally, somebody without an accent. Hi, everybody. Jimmy, alcoholic. Grateful to be alive and sober, and it's customary where I come from to let you know that I have a home group. It's called the Design for Living Group on the Jersey Shore. I have a sponsor. I have a service sponsor. Apparently, I need a lot of adult supervision. Sponsor a lot of guys, and most importantly, I've been sober since my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and that was on March 28, 1987. So extremely grateful for this way of life, and extremely grateful to be here today. I feel like I'm at a bar. This is nice. Yeah, belly up to the bar, they used to say. A lot of thanks to Roger and the committee for doing this hard work. Looks simple today, but a lot of hard work goes on behind us. We have a thing in New Jersey where we'd like to trade our sponsees. And what I mean by that is last night at dinner with Joe, I was able to trade Roger to Joe for 2 draft choices and $1,000. And what a great deal. But just to give you a little visual where I come from, I live 60 miles south of New York City on the ocean, that other ocean, the Atlantic Ocean, and very affluent area, very fortunate. Locals like to call it the Irish Riviera. Members of Alcoholics Anonymous like to call it Cirrhosis by the Sea. I mean, it's a lot like this place here, you know, but I love it down there. I'm just really grateful to be here, and Roger tagged me with a topic of darkness to light, and, you know, I did a workshop last week in Long Island, New York, with a couple of friends of mine, and basically the same thing as this, you know, talking about the gift of sobriety, talking about, you know, the age of miracles. It's not coming. If you knew, the age of miracles is right now, right here, right now. If you're not drinking today and you're in a room of Alcoholics Anonymous, thank God, right, for what we got. But I think the best way to go about this talk for me is I need to tell you about me, right? How did I get so dark? How did my life become so dark? How did I do what June just talked about, admit my powerlessness, you know, be able to be open-minded and willing to seek a power greater than myself and then eventually make that decision? You know, and the decision is really not, you know, is it to work the rest of the steps? Yeah. Is it to turn my will and my life over to the care of God? Yeah. But I think really it's to walk into the darkness of my life. You know, my sponsor today says it all the time, that if you're going to grow spiritually, you know, you can't avoid your problems. You got to really face your problems head on, right? That's the only way we're going to grow in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. So I always like to start by saying that I was born perfect and I was quickly handed over to these two character defects called mom and dad. And I say that in a joking way, but, you know, I got that delusion, you know, and you might have that delusion too, that nothing's your fault, right? And all my parents ever really tried to do for me was to give me a life of, you know, good morals, values, education, you know. But I took all that goodness they gave me and I rolled it up into a nice ball and I stuffed it right down my parents' throat. And I introduced my parents to a way of life that they never even knew existed, you know. And I grew up, I'm 66 years old. I grew up in, like I said, northern New Jersey. I grew up on the Hudson, the Jersey side of the Hudson River, right across from New York City. See a couple of Jersey people here. I'm kind of surprised because I didn't think the Federal Witness Protection Program came this far west. I thought it stopped around Colorado, but welcome, guys. I won't let them know, you know. It's like, Pam, where is she? You're from Jersey? Yeah. I could tell you got an attitude already. Then she came out to me. She goes, hey, do you know any gangsters like Tony Soprano? Pam, Pam, Pam. That's a TV character. I come from the Jersey. Sure, I know real people like Snooki, Situation. Now, if you're over 40, lean into somebody young. They'll explain that. So I'm growing up in this very blue-collar, you know, city-like environment in the 50s, late 50s, early 60s, tough neighborhood I grew up in. Everyone's a union worker, everyone's a cop, everyone's a fireman, I mean, truck driver. My dad was a butcher. The only requirement for membership in my neighborhood was 5 or more kids, you know. So there was always something going on where I lived, you know, and you know, Birthday parties, christenings, graduations, you name it, there was one thing that was always at every event, and that was King alcohol. And I heard Clancy say it many years ago, and it's so true, you know, the disease of perception, right? The way I looked at alcohol, the way I thought drinking was going to be was one, fun. I would watch my old man, I would watch my brothers, my uncles, the neighbors, the women in my neighborhood, and it just seemed like there was a sense of ease and comfort once they took that first drink. And they had laughs and they had fun. I mean, yeah, there was a few fist fights, but that's just normal, right? Freedom. I think alcohol equates to freedom. There's some sense of feeling that I'm just okay no matter how I feel about myself. I take a few pops and I'm good to go, you know? So these ideas, growing up, I just thought alcohol was fun. And, you know, and I got this guy called Dad. He's cunning, he's baffling, he's powerful in his old way. My dad's a real tough guy. My dad's a World War I vet. He's wound up. Let me put it this way. My dad's a lunatic. That makes it really easy. And I hate to say it like that, but the truth of the matter is, my dad, we would probably diagnose him with PTSD today. I mean, he had a lot of things. My dad was a great provider, but he would never sit you down and talk about how he's feeling. He would never talk about any kind of emotions. He never talked about anything, really. You know, and my dad was an angry, angry guy, you know, filled with rage all the time. You never knew when he was going to blow a top. You know, but what I would witness as a 6-year-old, 7 years old, this perception, seeing my old man, he would come home every night at 5 o'clock, and my mom would make these two pitchers, one called martinis, the other one called Manhattans. And my dad would take that first drink, like everyone in this room today. And he changed. Something happened. All of a sudden, he became a guy that wanted to have a catch in the backyard. He became a guy with a kind of a sense of humor. He just became different, like many of us, when we take that first drink. But don't let me fool you. There were those days, and those days looked something like this. My old man would take that first drink, and all of a sudden, the kitchen plates would be flying across the kitchen. The kitchen chairs would be flying across the kitchen. One of us young kids would be flying across the kitchen. You know, so at 5 o'clock, 5:05, every night in my house, you'd never know where we were. My two brothers and two sisters, a lot of nights we were under the covers at 5 o'clock with the covers over our head waiting for the tornado to blow through the house. And then when it was done, we would come out and, you know, hey, Mom, the wind stopped blowing. Nothing I'm out of here, you know, whatever that saying is, you know. And all of a sudden, you know, we go in the living room, we go in the kitchen, and nothing was ever discussed. Now, that doesn't make me alcoholic, but it makes me a kid that's pretty neurotic. I'm a kid that's filled with amazing fear. Fear of loud noises, fear of yelling, fear of screaming, fear of fear, 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 the evil and corroding threat. I'm also a kid that just grows up with so much insecurity. I don't feel good about myself, and it's not their fault. It's just that the way I perceive life, that life is going to be tough. I'm, you know, 6'8". I don't even know why I'm thinking this way. But worse than anything, I got secrets, just like June just talked about. I'm a kid that lives in a family. I'm a kid that lives in a house. I'm a kid that lives in a neighborhood. What goes on in your house, what goes on in your family, what goes on in your neighborhood, you never talk about. So by the age of 8, 9, 10, 11 years old, I have stuffed down into me every emotion possible. I have stuffed down every fear, every insecurity, every secret, and they've never seen the light of day. I'm just waiting to explode. And that day happened on 13 years old. I'm in a cemetery with 5 guys that I know to this day, 52 years ago, and I'm about to have my first drink. And here comes that bottle of Colt 45 malt liquor. And I go in there and I grab the neck of that bottle with so much fear, but I took that first drink. Here comes that second bottle, it's called Mohawk Blackberry Brandy. And I start drinking on that blackberry brandy. And what I could tell you about my first night drinking is I blacked out, puked purple for about 2 weeks, took a beating from my father, and my mother apparently grounded me for life. But the hook was in, that magic elixir. It was doing for me what I could never do for myself, the sense of ease and comfort that comes by taking those few drinks, right? Little do I know, I just stepped on the path that goes straight to pitiful, incomprehensible demoralization. And if you're new today, that means I went to hell, like many of us in this room, because over the next 16 years of my drinking, full-blown alcoholism and homelessness living on the streets of northern New Jersey. And that's my story in a nutshell. So what kind of darkness do I have? You know, I got all of this. Old timers used to say that alcoholism is a soul sickness caused by a separation from God and disconnect from each other. And as my drinking got progressive, my behaviors got progressive. I'm a street kid. I live in an age when my mom would open up the door at 8 o'clock in the morning, throw us all out. She knew we'd eat somewhere along the day, and the door would be open like 7 o'clock at night. So my life has really been growing up on the streets. And yeah, my parents always tried to do the best for me, but they weren't my idols. My idols were the guys on the corner. The guys that, you know, the most important person in my neighborhood was the bookie, right? That guy had a nice car. He had money in his pocket. He had the good-looking girlfriend. He just seemed like a guy that just was someone I wanted to be like. And I tried to be like that until it almost killed me. So growing up on the streets, you know, you don't talk about anything you feel about. You don't talk about anything. There's a code of the streets. Real men are strong. Real men are this. Real men are... And little by little, I'm drinking, and I'm pushing down these things. I'm pushing down these things, and I'm pushing down these things. And what happens to me is, you know, like a lot of people, you know, I got that double-edged sword life, you know. Half of me is, you know, blaming everyone for the life I have. Then there's another half of me that's always looking, seeking, searching for something out there to fix this thing inside of here. Because very quickly, the progression of alcoholism was killing me. And I didn't know what was wrong. And I really believed that there was something out there that could fix this thing inside here. So as I aged, by the time I'm 18 years old, I'm an everyday drinker. You know, and back then in Jersey, you know, on the East Coast, I don't know how it was back here, but, you know, if your chin could hit a bar, a top of a bar, you were getting served. So by 15, 16 years old, we were hanging out in the bars already, you know, and... So as this progression is going on, you know, a lot of my friends started to go out, they started to get married, they started to get jobs, they started to have kids, and I can't get off the bar stool. And I don't understand what June talked about is this first step drink concept. You know, the first drink gets you loaded. That is the most ridiculous thing I've ever heard in my life. And when I came to AA, I swear it had to be the last 20, had to be the outside issues. How can the first drink get you drunk? And I didn't understand that for a long period of time. But here I am, I'm in the bar. Now, I'm no different than anyone in this room right now. I got goals, dreams, aspirations, I want to be somebody. But I go down the bar to figure it out. You know? And yeah, I've had high school, and I had the greatest 10 years of my life. They call that college in New Jersey. You know, I've done all those things. But the truth of the matter is, I go to the bar to figure it out, and I take that first drink. And before you know it, 6 o'clock at night, before you know it, I'm in New York City at some after-hours bar, coming out of a bar at 6 o'clock in the morning. How did it happen again? You know, singing the Alki National Anthem, I'll never do this again. And I keep on doing it over and over again. But I'm in a bar one day, and I see a pretty woman against the back wall. I grab my sister. I say, hey, introduce me to her, and I'll buy an illegal substance. She does, and 4 months later, I'm married. That's how I used to do relationships. Truth of the matter is, I'm irresponsible. I'm non-caring. I have fallen under the delusion that some external thing is going to make me feel better in here. See, what I found out in here is that alcoholism doesn't come in a bottle. It comes in my mind, and my mind is filled with a lot of delusions about a lot of things. But I'm convinced that if I just get married, everything will be okay. What I don't realize is I have the inability not to take that first drink. And I jump in this marriage, and I walk out of this marriage after 4 months. I leveled her, I leveled the family, I level everyone. I don't know how to be responsible, I don't know how to be caring. I don't like her, I don't like me. I mean, it's the whole list of things, from here to the back wall of why I need to be out of this marriage. I'm an everyday drunk. I'm drinking around the clock. I can't stop once I start. I take off at Boca Raton, Florida, where I have some friends down there. And I'm looking out the condo, out the glass windows. I can see the beach, the bikinis, the boats, all that stuff. But I'm getting that knock at the door. The knock we all get of terror, frustration, bewilderment, despair. The four horsemen are showing up on a regular basis. I'm restless. I'm irritable. I'm discontent. I'm 27 years old, 28 years old at this time. Full-blown alky, don't know it. Still think it's outside issues that are bothering me, is the problem. Circumstances is what's wrong with my life. If I could just get the right job, if I could just get this, that. I have the Christmas list for everything, and I can't stop drinking. And somewhere along the lines, God cracked my skull open. And in my skull, he put this chalkboard. And on this chalkboard were these three emotions of shame, guilt, and remorse. And it seems to me at this point in my life that everything I've done creates some sort of shame. Shame of not being a good son. Shame of not being a good sibling. Shame of failing out of college. Shame, 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 shame. Most alcoholics have shame-based identities. I'm riddled with fear about everything. And remorse and guilt, the things I'm doing to the people I hurt. But you see, I still have an answer. We call that Johnny Walker Red in New Jersey. And all I need to do is crack the seal of that bottle. I don't even need to take that first drink yet. And all of a sudden, that grandiosity comes back. And all of a sudden, that little kid comes back. And it's your fault, it's her fault, it's their fault, it's everyone's fault. And what happens to me is I come back to New Jersey, but I'm so ashamed by what I've done to the people and leveled the people in my life, I make a decision. That decision is to, you know, just not get in contact with anyone. So I decide to live on the streets. Now, that wasn't the plan for as long as it happened. I figured a couple days on the streets, stay at someone's house, stay in a car, stay in a motel, do something like that, I'll be okay. Nineteen months later, I'm still homeless on the streets. I'm doing that aimless walk that we talk about. And as my old sponsor would say, one night on the streets is one night too many. I'm selling my blood. I'm doing things that are so horrific. I'm doing things that are so traumatic. If I took a basketball made out of glass and just threw it on the ground right here, that was an example of my life, just shattered. 29 years old, dying of this thing called alcoholism, and I don't even know I have a drinking problem. A blind man can see that I have a drinking problem, but I couldn't see it. Aren't we the last ones to always see it? And what happens to me is I walk into a bar one night. This old timer comes up to me and goes, "Hey, they're hiring guys like you in Newark Airport." Finally, being seen for my potential. I never flew a plane before, but I'm looking forward to the experience. And back in the old days, I don't even know if that this airline had enough gas to get past Connecticut, but I think it was called People's Express. Old airline. Eventually became Continental, you know, became United, really. And the job was to take the luggage that was over there and hopefully get it on the plane that's over there. I'd like to segue right now and say, if any of you folk here are flying through Newark Airport in the 80s and you're still waiting for your luggage, well, I'll make amends after this. But I'm desperate, and I'm dying. And me and two guys rob a car, and we go to Newark Airport the next day. All three of us is now sober over 37 years. It's a miracle. The immense process that we made that to the guy that we stole the car off is hysterical. So I go out to Newark Airport the next day. Dirty, grimy. Every other word is a profanity out of my mouth. I'm really in trauma, and I don't know it. I am, like, from living on the streets, traumatized of the things I've been doing for 18, 19 months. And we go into Newark Airport, and it was a room as big as this, and you can imagine an airport, how many people are walking around. And the interview process looked like this. Can you lift the suitcase? Yeah, you're hired. I mean, that was it. And I remember walking out and sitting in a chair like Joe's sitting right now. My arms were up there. I can remember this as clear as a bell. I couldn't tell you how I felt in that moment until I landed in here with you, until I opened up this blue book and eventually turned to page 8 and read Bill's story. When Bill talks about no words could tell the loneliness and despair, I felt in a bitter morass of self-pity. Quicksand stretched around me in all directions. I met my match. I've been overwhelmed. Alcohol was my master. And for the first time at the age of 29 years old, sitting in a chair in Newark Airport, I think drinking's a problem. And as I sat there with the wind blowing through my soul, dying of this thing, a complete stranger came next to me and sat next to me. And after a couple of minutes, this man looked at me and said, "What's your problem?" People weren't asking me how my 401k was doing or how that new Porsche I pulled up in. No, what's wrong with you? And I spit my life story up on this guy in 10 minutes. And he looked at me and said, "I have the answer for you." This is pre-cell phone, pre-beeper days. Yes, there was a time, young people. This gentleman pulled out a piece of paper and he wrote down the street. He goes, "You know where this is?" I said, "That's my old neighborhood." Put a number in front of that sheet and asked me a very important question. "Is it possible for you not to take a drink the rest of this day?" And I was honest with the guy. I said, "I want to drink right now. It's like 10 o'clock in the morning." He said, try not to drink and be in front of this address at 7 o'clock tonight. And all I can tell you is, but for the grace of God, at 7 o'clock that night, I showed Roger that spot where I stood. Knees knocking, stomach churning, my mind speaking to me a thousand languages. Did I even meet a guy? Was I even in Newark Airport today? I was so delusional. I was so broken. I was so sick. I was everything you guys know about. Think about the day before day one. How did you feel that day? Think about the week before day one. How did you feel that week? That's me. I'm mocus. That's an old-time AA term. I don't even know what it means, but I like it. Mocus, you know? And here I am, you know, I'm standing on that thing, and all of a sudden, a 1979 Chevy Impala pulls up. The stranger's driving the car, and there's a bunch of other strangers in the car. And they pulled up on me, and they rolled down the window. Yes, we used to have to roll down the window. Yeah. It's like this. They rolled down that window, and they said that most spiritual thing you'll ever hear in Alcoholics Anonymous. Get in the car. Right? And I got in the car with these men. They took me to my grandma's school, 500 yards away. And he walked me into my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I thought it was bingo. I was surprised that it was AA. I was, big Catholic church, you know, there's always bingo going on. And walking into grace doesn't feel like walking into grace. It feels like I was walking out of complete chaos. I didn't understand the enormity of what was going to happen to a guy like me as I walked down those metal chairs. As I walked past that cafeteria, I remember looking in that cafeteria as a sixth grader, seventh grader, eighth grader, already drinking, 13 years old, 14 years old, 15 years old, with every dream, every aspiration, every goal. I wanted to be somebody, but I didn't understand the power of King Alcohol. I didn't understand that first drink concept. And as I walked down the end of the hall, I could smell coffee, and that's being generous. Because back in the day, I don't know if this coffee ever made it to the West Coast. It probably didn't. But we used to drink a thing called Sanka. Something that the astronauts invented with Tang to drink on the moon. But for the sake of the story, it was Sanka. And I tell you this because, you know, I walked down to that room and I met the most important person we have in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. We call him the greeter. And I grabbed this young man's hand, or old man's hand, and that flimsy reed, and he pulled me into you. And today I understand that's the powerful and loving hand of God. And it starts my journey in Alcoholics Anonymous. I wish I could tell you I was into it right away. I didn't understand what was going on. Day one, I got a sponsor. It became a home group. Life started to get better. I started to bounce back physically. I got a job. I got back with that wife. We have two little AA babies. My life got fast, very quick, fast. But at 5 years without a drink, I got a rope. I just need a bridge to jump off. You see, nothing has changed in my life. I have fallen under the delusion that abstinence is a solution to a spiritual malady. But in truth, I'm still that 8-year-old, 10-year-old, 11-year-old in a grown-up body filled with secrets, filled with fear, filled with anger and rage and all that stuff that goes on inside all of us. And I'm not talking about it because pride and ego have taken their right place now. Jimmy, how you doing? Everything's great as the veins are about to pop out of my neck. I don't know how to talk about these stuff. I'm a street guy. We don't talk about emotions. I am my old man. I don't know how to talk about any feelings. I don't know how to talk about emotions. I'm like, yeah, quick answers. Let's get this conversation over with. And that's how I am. But my life is getting better externally. And to the untrained eye, it looks like normal living is a solution to alcoholism. And I'm doing a talk on Second Step, and I'm lying to all of you because I'm paralyzed by what you think of me. At the end of the meeting, a guy comes up to me. There's a long line. People are shaking my hand. Thanks a lot. Thanks a lot. Guy walks up to me, and he says, well, in Jersey, we say doom, but it starts with an F. And that's what he says to me. Screwed, basically. And I want to start a fist fight in rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous because I don't know how to face confrontation without violence. I don't know how to face resistance without resistance. But I take a step back and I look at this guy and I said, you're right, I need help. I need help. And I find myself in a railroad room apartment that next day, getting a test. The test that maybe some of you guys in this room have gotten. First question this man asked me was, how long can you hold your breath? How long can you hold your breath, Jim? How long can you be in a 12-step program and not work the 12 steps? What does your relationship with God look like? I'm Catholic, I believe in God. What's God have to do with any of this? What makes you alcoholic? Best I could stammer out of my mouth is, I drank too much. No idea about the physical allergy, no idea about the mental obsession. Then he asked me a question that a lot of you guys might not believe, but this is the way it was in my neighborhood in the 80s. Where's your big book? And I looked at him and said, what's a big book? Because we didn't talk about this book back then in my neighborhood. Speaker meetings, discussion meetings, 12 and 12 meetings. It wasn't until Joe and Charlie came through the Northeast in the 90s, early 90s, that things started to change in my neighborhood. So here I am, you know, dying in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. And what just happened on this particular day with this gentleman was he painted me into a corner. He painted me so far into the corner, I had no choice but to take one of those two alternatives, spiritual life, spiritual death. He said, Jim, nothing has changed in your life other than not drinking, right? He says, we have two goals in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, goals he believed, the kind of goals I believe in today. First goal, the obvious one, don't pick up the first drink. But the second goal is the goal I think everyone in this room wants to attain, and that's to step into the sunlight of the Spirit, that place. You know, if I took every chair and I put it against that back door and said, in order to get out there, we have to take actions that we probably don't even believe in, but we're taking those actions to get out into the sunlight of the Spirit, because the sunlight of the Spirit, that place, is a place where we're all going to experience freedom. We're all going to experience the bondage of self being removed. We're all going to experience all the promises that our literature gives us. We're all going to experience what Bill Wilson called the perfect place, utopia. But in order to get out there, I got to walk through the darkness of my life. One of the greatest readings we have just happened on Wednesday. If you're a Daily Reflections reader, May 1st, I've read this every time. I've read this 1,000 times. It's a side of myself that I refuse to look at that rules me. I must be willing to look at the dark side in order to heal my mind and my heart, because that's the road to freedom. I must walk into darkness to find the light and walk into fear to find peace. The way the old timers used to say is, AA is like a big bonfire. A lot of people are walking around the fire, but the fire is eventually going to go out. If you really want to be free, if you really want to experience God and the 12 steps and recovery and all that stuff, you got to walk through the fire and get your ass burnt and feel the uncomfortability of change. One thing I can't do for anyone in this room today, none of you could do it for me, and none of you could do it for each other, and that's put willingness in your heart. Willingness is an inside job. And what makes us willing? Well, circumstances, being sick and tired of being sick and tired, sitting in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. When's it going to get better? When's it going to get better? When's it going to get better? Or as our good friend Ralph likes to say, a good whooped ass. I had a good whooped ass. I was willing to go into the darkness of my life. And my first original fourth step was the most powerful thing I've ever written. Getting down to causes and conditions of the things in me that are blocking me from God and blocking me from you. The common manifestations, as it talks about. Looking at all the rage and anger that I had inside of me, getting it on paper, getting it out of here, getting it on paper. Looking at all that fear, looking at all the harms I've caused sexually, financially, emotionally. Taking a real hard, deep dive look at all the expectations I put on you to make me feel better. All those unhealthy expectations. And those unhealthy dependencies, especially on women, that if I'm with you, I'll feel better. Again, a drink with two legs. But I needed to go into the darkness and uncover, discover, and discard these things. And I had to do something that I thought was a weakness, because tough guys look at this stuff as a weakness. Little did I know it strengthened this guy's. I had to become vulnerable to another man. We call him a sponsor. And I had to put my cards on the table, and I had to talk about all that stuff with him. And I had the most unbelievable experience of my life doing my first original fifth step. It was a cleansing. It was letting all that stuff come out, right? Hour after hour after hour. And at the end of that hour, I went to a place called Liberty State Park, which overlooks New York City on the Jersey side of the Hudson River. And I walked out on this pier, and I sat down on this pier, and I read the first five proposals, all the stones properly in place, like all the instructions that we read on page 75 at the end of the fifth step. And I sat down, and I looked to my right. Right there, the Statue of Liberty. Looked across the river, right in front of me, the two towers of the World Trade Center. Looked to my left, and right there was Ellis Island. Symbols of freedom. 32 years old, tears coming down my eyes, I could feel the arms of God wrapped around me for the first time. For the first time in my life, ever in my life, I knew I was going to be okay as long as I hung out with you guys and did what this book has asked me to do. And then I fell for the biggest trap. The biggest trap in Alcoholics Anonymous, I fell prey to comfortability. All of a sudden, overtime was important. Coaching basketball was very important with my kids. Coaching baseball with my son, very important. And little by little did I understand or didn't see that I started to drift in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I live on the ocean, that other ocean, the warm ocean. If I took my boat on the ocean and pointed it east, you guys don't see this, but I see the beautiful sunrise every day. Most beautiful thing in the world. I see the curvature of the earth while I'm on that boat. I'm looking east. But what I don't see is that I'm drifting from town to town to town. And little by slowly, I do the same thing in Alcoholics Anonymous. You see, I didn't come to AA and get on some spiritual rocket ship and went up, up, and away. That's not my story. My story is I've grown, hit a wall, I've grown, I've hit a wall, I've grown, I've hit a wall. We call them second surrenders, third surrenders, tenth surrenders, whatever it is. And here I am in trouble again, and I can't even see it. Karen, we're always the last one to see it. 6 years sober, 8 years sober, 9 years sober, 10 years sober. A lot of problems at home again. A lot of financial problems. A lot of fighting going on. July 8th, 1997, my son's birthday. July 9th, my daughter's birthday. And July 10th, the cops are hauling me out of my house, stone cold sober, because my anger has exploded into a rage because I'm living a double life in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm not telling any of you guys. And I get to tell this story with permission because I have to ask my wife of today, who is not my first wife, for permission to tell the story because that's important in my relationship. But at 10 years sober, I found a woman in AA that understands. And I blow up my life in Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm the guy who builds a beautiful spiritual structure up for myself, and I tear it down with a senseless series of sprees. And you don't need to be drinking to blow up your life in Alcoholics Anonymous. Just sponsor a bunch of people, you'll find that out. And I'm living a double life again in Alcoholics Anonymous. And at 13 years sober, I'm telling my sponsor 30% of what's really going on. I got secrets. I got more secrets now than I did when I came into AA. I got an incredible amount of anger and fear and rage inside of me. But see, the ego and the pride are back in place. In How It Works, Dr. Bob, Bill writes a paragraph specifically, Dr. Bob, at some of these we balked. We thought we could find an easier, softer way, but we could not. With all your innocence at our command, we beg you to be fearless and thorough from the very start. Some of us have tried to hold on to our old ideas, and the result was nil until we let go, absolutely. Why can't I let go? Why can't I change? Why am I resisting everything that you guys offer me and put on my plate? Comes down to one word, pride. My pride won't allow it. My pride is the essence of my self-centeredness. My pride leads to perception of every character defect. And more importantly, pride will step in when I'm in spiritual stagnation. And when you're sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, and this is your recovery, here, God, take the drink problem from me and I'll handle the rest of my life, you're in trouble. And I was in trouble. And at 13 years without a drink, I walked into a bar last night because I understand what Dr. Bob was talking about. I was stuck between a rock and a hard place. He uses two words that I can't pronounce. And here I am in a bar. Bartender, give me a drink. Puts it right there. Devil and the angel pop out. Drink it. Don't drink it. Drink it. Don't drink it. Drink it. Don't drink it. God help me. Drink it. Drink it. Drink it. When all of a sudden a hand goes around the glass and pulls it back. And when I looked up, the bartender who didn't serve me to drink, another bartender, just happened to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. What are you doing? Throwing my life away. The human ego is the most powerful thing that really dictates us. 2 weeks later, I'm in a meeting. This guy, Peter M., is doing a workshop. 2 weeks earlier, I want a drink. 2 weeks later, I'm judging this guy in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's amazing. Like, this guy's too good to be true. Huh? Are you kidding me? Meanwhile, I still got the rope marks around my neck from trying to kill myself. But at the end of that meeting, I asked this guy to help me, and he did. And he started to take me through the steps. That relationship that I had with that woman in AA blew up real fast. I threatened her, because that's what tough guys do. We threaten people. And little did I know, she called 911 on me. Little did I know that the cops come to your house no matter what, if you hang up or not. Little did I know that she was going to file a restraining order against me. Little did I know that I would be in a courtroom at 13 years sober, facing a judge for my behavior again. The common manifestations of living a life on self-will, filled with rage and anger and fear and blaming. You know, when you live with a grievance, you always blame somebody, right? It's not my fault. You always take things personal. Why is this happening to me? I'm a good guy. But more importantly, the delusion of control. I think I can control this situation, but I'm in front of a judge. I can't control anything. And I see her at the end of the hall with a lawyer. I'm like, oh, I didn't know you had to bring a lawyer to one of these things. And I figured that they're just going to bring me in, pat me on the hand, and say, Jimmy, behave. But that didn't happen on this particular day. This judge is standing up in front of me. And he's got a New Jersey meeting book and a red marker. And he's circling meetings. You're banned from this meeting. You're banned from this meeting. You're banned from this meeting. He banned me from 5 meetings that this woman went to. My first question was, who the hell gets banned in AA? I do. But that's where my behavior brought me. And I hated this woman. I wanted to kill this woman. That's strong language. But I was trying to protect my ego and my pride. And I would go to anyone who would listen to me. But Peter wouldn't listen to me. And he said, we're going to do inventory on this. And we need to do inventory on this. So yeah, if you're familiar, I'm not going to go through the mechanics of that. But, you know, column 1, her. Column 2, I had a list from here to New Jersey of why I resented this woman. Column 3, yeah, how it affected me in those 7 areas of self. But then again, the magic column. Column 4 was the nature of my wrongs. Where was I wrong? And I started to see some things in it. This thing we did last week was called Prayers and Promises, but it's the same stuff we're talking about today. We ask God to help us show us the same tolerance and pity and patience that we would cheerfully grant a sick friend. When a person is offended, we say to ourselves, this is a sick man or woman. How can I be helpful to them? God, save me from being angry. Thy will be done. So I'm asked to bring this into prayer on a daily basis about this woman. The problem is, every time I heard someone with her kind of accent, every time I saw a woman with blonde hair, every time I saw someone that reminded of me, of her, whether it was in life or in real, or whether it was in a commercial or was in a movie, or whatever it was, I just couldn't let go of this resentment. I couldn't let it go. I couldn't let it go. I couldn't let it go. And yeah, we call that the sick man prayer, or the prayer for the sick man, I guess. I don't even know what it's called. Then somebody said to me, hey, Jimmy, why don't you take this anger you got towards this woman and bring it into Gwen Law's story, right? She was from California. I'm sure June knew who she was. Freedom from Bondage, back in the book on page 551. Now, I've heard a lot of people in AA say, that's garbage, that don't work. That's not my experience. We all have our own experiences, but here I am. I start to take this into prayer on a daily basis. If you have a resentment you want to be free of, you will pray for the person or the thing that you resent, you will be free. Promise. If you ask in prayer and everything you want for yourself to be given to them, you will be free. Promise. Ask for their health, their prosperity, and happiness, and you will be free. Even when you don't really want it for them and the prayers are only words and you don't mean it, go ahead and do it anyway. Do it every day for 2 weeks and you will find that you have come to mean it for them. You'll realize that you have used it to f- You will realize that where you used to feel bitterness, resentment, and hatred, you now feel compassion, understanding, and love. I take this into prayer on a daily basis. Like any resentment that we might have in his room right now, any grievance, any anger. Wasn't 2 weeks, I could tell you that. 2 months, I wake up. I have a routine of prayer and meditation on a daily basis in my house. I say the prayer. I'm praying for everything in her life that I want in my life. Every attribute that I want in my life that I can show you and give to you, I'm praying that this woman has the same thing. So I pray for her forgiveness. I pray for her health. I pray for her prosperity. I pray for all those things for her that they happen in her life. And on this particular day, 2 months later, I feel something different. I could feel God enter my heart. I could feel God enter my soul. All of a sudden, I'm not angry at this woman. All of a sudden, that has been removed. All of a sudden, I'm willing to even go make amends to this person. Little did I know, and I'm sorry for this lack of opportunity, but that woman wound up committing suicide at 28 years sober. And I never had that opportunity to clean that up. Can I drive to where she lived and where she's buried and make, of course I can. But the point of the story is that when you're holding on to something or you're holding on to these resentments, when you're still living in the darkness of your life, you'll never be free. So the actions that we take here, and this is really the age of miracles, is that we're able to look at this stuff, write about this stuff, pray on this stuff, and eventually take those actions. And I had to do that with the resentment towards her, the fears I had towards her. You know, fear revolves around three things: not getting what I want. And in this case, I wanted emotional security, I wanted financial security, I wanted sexual security. Because I'm such a piece of crap that, you know what, I have to get from you to make me feel better. Old behavior, same behavior before I even picked up a drink. Behavior that I've displayed through my sobriety. I always had this unhealthy dependency on something out there that's going to fix me in here. But here I am, I got this fear. And why I have fear is because I don't know how to live a life of presence. The fear prayer is great. God, please take away this fear. Direct my attention to what you'd have me be, not do. Fear makes me react. And what the prayer is asking me is to get present to the only moment any of us have in this room, and that's right now. We have the story about God in the box. Everyone know what that story is about? Today is May 4th. God is present in this room right now, in all our lives right now. But God gives us free will, and I like to drift a little bit. I'm already thinking about that flight back to New Jersey tomorrow, and how I can't wait to get to Newark Airport. I got a doctor's appointment on, I think, Wednesday. I'm playing golf on Tuesday. I'm drifting. I got to do a thing next week somewhere. God says, have a nice trip, Jim. But when you really need me, really want me, come back to May 4th. See, God in a box is like a calendar. And each calendar is a calendar day in a box, if you look at a calendar. And see, fear makes me go out of the calendar, May 4th. And my job, through prayer, through meditation, through inventory, through conversations with you, is start to stay as present as possible. And when I wrote that sex inventory, it was all about those 9 questions at the end. It was all that stuff. Old timers used to say this all the time. If you think of a drink, reach for a drunk. If you think of a spree, reach for a drunk. Because through this whole inventory process, they keep on telling me that when I get jammed up in my head emotionally or whatever the case, character defects, whatever you want to call it, go help another alcoholic. It'll always save the day. And if you're sitting in here and you experience that, you know exactly what I'm talking about. So this thing about going from darkness to light and getting out there into the sunlight of spirit, it's really an easy road. The problem is I like to come back into the darkness once in a while. And see, nothing grows in the dark. That if I really want to be free, if I really want to experience the promises and the freedom that goes on in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, I got to let you in on my secrets. It's the hardest thing for a lot of us to do. And I'm sure there's people in this room right now with secrets. But to become vulnerable, to talk to another person, to really lay it on the line, what's going on inside of here, not in here, but deep down in my soul, that's the only place I'm ever going to experience freedom. And thank God for this inventory process. How many years have I heard people say, oh, look out for that fourth step? This is the greatest tool that God has ever given us drunks like us to get free of. To look at this stuff, get it out of our heads, get it on paper, and then more importantly, bring it to a sponsor and open up our life to them and to share about the things that are blocking me from God and blocking me from you. You know, the joy of living is what the 12 steps are going to talk about. I can't live free when I'm walking around with secrets. Matter of fact, having a secret robs us of any sanity. And when I looked up the word sanity, we always hear about the crazy, stupid things we pull when we're loaded, but not talking about that. The definition of sanity is to think and behave in a normal and rational manner. And when I got to cover up my secrets with lies to protect me from you, I'm not living a normal life. I'm living a life of bondage. And that story, Freedom from Bondage, is a perfect example of some of the tools that I could use in Alcoholics Anonymous to get free. What a blessing. The age of miracles is not coming, guys. It's here right now. I hope you all enjoy it. Thanks a lot.